Hello, and welcome to episode two of our Specialist Learning Disability Service podcast. It's Jenna Messenger, Specialist Learning Disability Nurse on This Is Your Journey. Really excited today. Dr. Paula Levitt, our Principal Clinical Psychologist and Joint Clinical Lead for our Specialist Learning Disability Service, has kindly agreed to come on to the podcast today. And the reason why I'm so excited is I really wanted to spend some time with Paula thinking about emotional development, especially for the young people that we work with, and thinking about how can we become more aware of the role of emotional development and why it's so important. It's something I'm really passionate about. So I'm really looking forward to just delving in with Paula and hearing how we can all support children and young people's emotional development with a learning disability. Firstly, Paula, it'd be really great just to hear a little bit about what your role is as a joint clinical lead. Bev kindly shared some of that with us in her first episode, but it'd be wonderful to hear how you see your role and what you do, please.
So as a clinical lead, it's obviously supporting the psychologist within our pathway, and it's also thinking about clinical governance and developing our pathways together, and making sure that we access interventions and assessments that are appropriate for our children with learning disability, because as you know, it's not great swathes of research out there, but it's making sure that we can access ones that are more most suitable for our children to get the best outcome for them.
Thank you. And if we're thinking of as emotional development for children with a learning disability, I'm thinking specifically for our moderate to severe to profound young people who access our service. In your own words, how would you describe what is emotional development?
So emotional development, for me, it sits alongside someone's chronological age development and then their cognitive development. The children we work with will have limitations and challenges in their cognitive development, and there's models out there that talk about when that happens. Usually these children's level of emotional development hasn't progressed at the same rate as their cognitive development, and so there's a model out there that talks about desynchrony of development, and that's specifically saying that children with learning disability and autism developmental needs, their emotional development is the last thing to develop alongside some of the more practical areas of development. And that's the bit we kind of need to focus on in terms of supporting them with catch up.
And why would you say it's important, our emotions are important for them, like you said, to support that catch up?
I suppose the bit for me is the children that we work with, Jenna, often don't, even if they have some language, they don't necessarily have the voice to be able to put into words where their emotional development is or how they're feeling or expressing their level of need, expressing their anxiety or distress. And so what we see, as you know, what we see is them expressing their distress if their emotional needs haven't been met through their behaviour. And I think there's a move for a long time now to think less about behaviour in terms of what we see and more about what's going on underneath for the children that we work with, so that their emotional world is considered. And again, for a long time now, there's been discussions about the inner world of a person with a learning disability is just as important as the rest of us who don't have a learning disability, so that inner world can be understood and explored. And that's where I think the emotional developmental models that we are talking about more and more, thankfully, at this stage are kind of coming to the forefront for us.
How did you become first aware? So you talk like you're absolutely, in my opinion, right, that behaviours can present on the surface, so that's what we can see. And actually, like you said, it can be an emotional development reason that's communicated through. Have you always been of that sort, or was things in your career showed you actually emotional development needs that space? And like you said, appreciate it's certainly got more gravitation.
So I've got a very clear memory back along before I moved to Devon, and I came across another clinical psychologist who worked in adult services, and we were talking about a young person who was moving from children's to adult services, and we were talking about his emotional development, and this particular psychologist made me aware of an approach by Dr. Pat Frankish, who's a clinical psychologist, and she has been promoting for many, many, many years now the idea of disability psychotherapy, and developed an assessment, an observational assessment, that helps us consider where a person's emotional development was at. And from that point, for me, that was a bit of a turning point in terms of focusing on behaviour and fixing behaviour. It's more about understanding a person's emotional expression through their behaviour, and that's kind of driven my career towards thinking about emotional development as opposed to just a surface behavioural research.
Definitely. I know Dr. Pat Frankish talks of a trauma-informed model, and emotional development, when we talk of trauma, I'm thinking for parents and carers, that can be really difficult because trauma feels quite a big word and quite loaded. How would you describe trauma, that's if you're working with someone, to explain what could it mean?
So you're right, it can be quite a scary word to use with children with disability, and it makes parents, carers worried about it. I think first of all, understanding that trauma can mean lots of different things to different people. So first of all, it's a threat to the person, either physically or more psychologically. And secondly, this is a phrase that I quite like to use at the moment, big T's and little T's.
Yeah.
And so the big T's are the big traumas that we automatically go to when we think about PTSD.
Yes.
Little T's are some of those small events that might happen to someone. You know, you might have, as a baby, you might have fallen off a chair, and you might have kind of bumped into a little accident or something like that. Or you might have got lost in a shopping centre. And the idea of big T's and little T's is that there are different events that all of us will interpret differently in terms of the level of threat. So what might be a little T for one person might turn into a big T for another person. It's about that individual's way of understanding the world and how safe they are within the world. So rather than think of the trauma involved being that big, massive trauma, something very scary that's happened, it's understanding, my perspective from understanding Pat Frankish's model, it's understanding that having a disability in itself can make things harder for us, and that it's harder for people. And having a learning disability comes with it some vulnerabilities. So it's being able to understand that helping somebody feel safe, feel secure in themselves is one of the important things that we need to make sure is a matter of course for a child and an adult with a learning disability.
I think what I took away from that, it didn't feel judgmental, and I wonder for parents and carers, when we talk of trauma, it can absorb that responsibility. It's my fault. I didn't cut my eye on the child, like you said, in the supermarket. As a parent or carer, it can be easily consumed. Is that what you're saying? It isn't judgmental, and we all individually interpret it. So
absolutely,
it's how we interpret it, how we feel it.
Yeah.
But also it feels like that there is consideration to support, to be able to help with it, but it's calling it out, saying it.
I think for me, you can just kind of hit the nail on the head there. So generally, when I've talked about this approach with parents, they haven't felt it was judgmental. They've seen it as my child is younger emotionally than their chronological and even at their cognitive age. There have been a couple of occasions when it's been really hard for a parent to hear that, there's lots of reasons for that.
Yeah.
But I think it is about stepping away from the blame culture and approaching the family and the adult unit around the child, the systems around the child, to have them think about where that child's at and what they can do to meet that child at their level.
Definitely. So I was thinking when you were talking the chronological age of a young person, we can perceive them to be that their emotional age is close to that chronological age. But if it isn't, that must be really difficult for them. But also, like you said, you could interpret it differently when actually emotionally, when we're younger, we haven't got those communication skills and maybe that ability to regulate in the same way. Thinking about the regulation part, could you explain co-regulation? So when I was saying then that when we're younger, so I'm thinking around the toddler stages, so I'd say that's 2 to 3, where emotionally little ones find that really difficult. So their emotions can be quite bigger and not manageable. And that I'm thinking of our young people who are older, like if they're 15, 16, but they're emotionally presenting younger. How would you think on co-regulation? What does that word mean?
Co-regulation to me is something we do, you know, get right when I look at children, and we do this quite intuitively, don't we? So when a little one is not able to regulate their emotional state, we will get down to their level, we will kind of let them know that we're here, we'll let them kind of work through that kind of big emotional kind of set of feelings that they're expressing, and just let them know that it's okay, that we've got them, and that they are being emotionally held. And we do that for our students, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess this model talks about co-regulation and attunement for adults, whether it's parents or, you know, kind of other family members or staff at school or people who are supporting that person. It's using that skill set that we generally have. Most of us have that skill set, not everybody, but most of us have that skill set to co-regulate. And rather than jumping into the behaviour, but just kind of going back to basics with the attunement, the co-regulation, so that person can be supported to work through the emotional bits that they're dealing with before we go into problem solving. Understand safety is important, but it's making sure somebody understands that they are emotionally held. The adult then becomes responsible for showing they are emotionally available for that person. I guess we know things like PACE, which helps us think about co-regulating children who maybe had care experiences. Using that type of skill set just to help that child, young person, understand that they're safe, that they're held. That's my understanding of co-regulation. That's my understanding of the function in terms of the model of emotional development, that we don't jump ahead and expect someone to follow the rules and, you know, manage their own behaviour, because their behaviour is communicating that emotional distress that they haven't yet been able to master. It's a skill that they haven't mastered. Mm. They haven't reached that developmental stage yet.
And there's that safety you're talking about, and I'm thinking that again, when you're younger, you need to feel safe, and also that availability and the felt like validation too. So you're really seeing and hearing that person, and you pointed a really good point there about also you're thoughtful of safety. So if a person is in such a heightened level of distress, it's about pitching, actually we want to try and get in there before than see actually. We see you're struggling. Usually, like with toddlers, we can sometimes see a build-up, always, but sometimes we can see it.
Yeah, I guess in terms of safety, there's physical safety and psychological safety.
Yes.
And it's balancing out what we need to do. If there's physical safety risks, then obviously that would be priority.
Yes.
And then we can go into the psychological safety.
And I was thinking when you talk co-regulation, to be able to support someone's emotions who might be really big, really not able to be contained, and I imagine you've got to think about your own how am I emotionally feeling and having that awareness? Because I imagine we can pass that on. So if we come more stressed, then actually that person's going to feel that, and that's going to emotionally lift them up because they're not in a place where they can emotionally manage themselves.
Absolutely. Again, it takes me back to what we do with little ones. So almost our tone of voice and our body kind of meets them at the level that they're at. And then as we bring our voice down, the rest of the little ones calm down as well. And I guess it's using some of those non-verbal skills that we have, micro skills, to help us regulate. We do have to think about young people that we work with might not be able to read non-verbal skills or hear some of our communication. So it's thinking what that young, that person in front of us, what their needs are, and meet them at the level they're at, and meet them with the communication that they need.
What do you think the difference is when we shift our mindset, when we start thinking about the emotional developmental needs, and like you said, meeting that young person? And I appreciate that we're talking generally here, but what difference do you think in your experience it makes when you can see, like you said, where parents, carers, transport staff and schools, enablers, whole range of people start going, actually, I see where you are, and emotionally meeting?
So for me, it strengthens the relationship compared to if you just meet somebody at where their behaviour is, then I guess, or if you just see the behaviour and people aren't, the child isn't responding to behavioural strategies, then get a disconnect there and less of a kind of satisfaction in the relationship. If you focus on a relational approach, which is another word for what we're talking about here, so meeting the person where they're at, it has the potential to strengthen the relationships. And you know, if you think about school staff and taxi transport staff, as you just mentioned, actually, if you develop a relationship through that type of skill, you're going to get more satisfaction in that relationship, you're going to see progress in your relationship, you're going to feel important to that young person, and it has that two-way effect of strengthening the relationship.
Feels like it would be quite rewarding. That relationship, I imagine, is kind of fundamental, is the young person being able to trust, and I imagine that has to be built over time, and you can do that by, if you're able to see where they're emotionally at. And I suppose I'm thinking, when you said about safety, thinking about the environment, how do we create a feeling of safety?
So just going back to the trust, I think you are there. If a young person thinks, oh, they've got me,
yes,
they know how to support me,
yeah,
maybe not even cognitively think that, but they just have this sense of, I'm held, I'm contained here, and you've got me, then of course, then that will actually build the trust up, and that will build the relationship up. And I guess the idea is actually they might not need to use their behaviours in the same way, because they are getting their emotional needs met. They're being emotionally held by that adult, that safe, emotionally available person. And so the idea is that we focus on building the relationship and the trust and the sense of safety. That reduces the need to display behaviours of their distress.
Definitely. Thinking of parents and carers, and thinking that I mentioned earlier about, to offer a co-regulation and attunement, you need to look after yourselves. Just wondered, is there things that can help a parent or carer to be able to just create space for themselves? I know we talk a lot these days, a lot of buzzword around mindfulness, but that can feel...
So I'm just going to come back to the trauma-informed care idea that you've spoken about. So one of the key factors there, if to deliver a trauma-informed care approach, if you're right, you do have to kind of have an awareness of your own emotional kind of being and well-being in order to provide that emotional availability for somebody else. So that's one part of that question is yes, it's important to be able to have awareness of your own level of regulation, emotional awareness. So parents obviously do need to kind of have an awareness of their own emotional state, because quite often that can mean if they're distressed, then that can transfer to other people around them, including the young person. I think the other bit that we know in terms of parent well-being is the additional impact of parenting a child with different needs, complex needs. So one of our colleagues, you know, has started a workshop for parents. And one of the activities that she does is something called the job description. And it asks a parent to have a think about all the additional tasks that they're faced with as a parent of a child with a disability or complex and additional needs. And it just helps that parent sit back and look about the additional demands that are placed on them in order for them to go, actually, I'm doing a really good job. I'm working really hard. I'm supporting and advocating for my child. And I'm having to navigate the complex system of the same world, which we know is complex. And there's lots of elements to it that's quite a burden for families to work through in terms of all the forms to fill in and the systems to navigate and the additional professionals that come in, like I said, who come in and ask you all these questions about your child with a view to support help. But actually it's additional work for parents and families to deal with. So it's just helping people with that knowledge, working extra hard as a parent, and it's important to do a bit of self-care or another phrase is essential maintenance, looking after yourself, making sure, you know, often families will say, I don't have time, because they are having to cope with additional tasks. But for me, it's important for them to have some of that time for themselves so they can maintain their own well-being, maintain their own resilience, with a view to being able to do all these tasks that we're asking them to do. So if we're asking a parent to do additional attunements to their child because their child has communication problems, has a learning disability, we're asking them to do more. So it's just helping them think about.
I was thinking also when you talk then that if your child or young person's younger, that I imagine emotionally they're going to need that more support. So that might bring some challenges to itself, because like you said, you're going to be increasing your emotional availability, your attunement. So that's going to take a little bit more energy from yourself too. That importance of looking after yourself sounds really key. With that understanding and that support around the young person, is there that hope for parents and carers that emotional development can grow? Do you think that it can develop then through the emotional development stages?
So Pat Frankie's model would say that yes, there is always potential for a child to move on to the next stage of emotional development. And it does take time, so it's I guess it's not one of those interventions like successions and this is fixed or made better. This is about all the adults around that child being able to provide that level of support and emotional availability. And if the child has a learning disability, that means it takes longer for them to take in that emotional availability. So there's almost like a barrier in the disability itself for them to take that information in. So it's not a quick process.
Yes.
But certainly if we're able to understand where that child's level of need is in terms of emotional development, if we're meeting them at too high level, that then we're putting higher expectations than their level of need is, then they're not getting it met. If we're putting it too low a level, then we're not stretching or challenging them. So it is about being able to understand where they're at just now and understand that they can grow those flags. And the other bit I think is probably helpful. If a child goes through an experience of stress or, we know the situation that when children move class groups, for example, or they have a change of important person in their lives, actually that can make them feel a little bit more insecure.
Yes.
And so at that point we need to look at putting a bit more of that emotional support, of that emotional availability, until the relationship is re-established. So like every year we hear from parents about how well they are about a child moving into a different class group or different class teacher or different teaching assistant or different escort for transport. And every year we see that eventually if that relationship is built on and developed, then the child's anxiety settles when they've made that good, trusting, emotionally available relationship. So it's back to the relational approach being key.
And I think also when you're talking, I'm thinking for parents and carers and families, that change and transition for themselves emotionally is an uncertain time, and for human beings, relationships are really important, like you said, being able to trust.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that endings, because we can't not have endings in our life, so be it we're the people, like you said, we form that relationship with, do you think that ending is really important for that we make endings, don't know if it's positive is the right word, but an understanding?
Yeah, I do. I think it's important to make it really clear when it's an ending. Particularly if some of our children haven't developed theory of mind yet. So but they might think, well, where's that person gone? I know you're talking about grief
in a later podcast.
About grief and loss. But I think it's really important for the child to have a very clear explanation of what's happening and what they can expect. So endings in terms of like moving classes,
yes.
The teacher's still in the actual school building, just not in their classroom, and there's a transfer of attachment from the person in old class to another class teacher. But that takes time, that takes building, as we know, building a relationship takes time and patience and trust. So I think endings, sometimes it's helpful to be visual. So I remember doing a piece of work many, many years ago with a man who I knew was going to struggle with an ending. And I had support from a supervisor who was a therapist as well as a psychologist. And we talked about kind of using something very visual. So we had a little activity at the end of each of our therapy session, this young man. And we decorated a little jar and I had a bag of marbles. And each day, each session, we'll take one of the marbles out of the bag and put it into the jar. And then at the end of our final session, all of the marbles were in the jar and the jar was decorated for him to take away.
Wow.
And that was really, to give him a physical representation of the number of sessions we were going to have, because it was a long-term piece of work I did many, many years ago. And B, it's also trans helping him, kind of process the transition and the ending. And the actual jar was a representation of all of the work that we did. So each pebble was a representation of the sessions that we had and the jar was a representation of the work as a whole. And I've used that many, many times since in different forms, maybe not a jar and pebbles because it might not work for different young people, but I think having a really clear process towards ending, because endings and relationships aren't concrete things. It's quite an abstract idea, isn't it? Quite an abstract concept. So making things as concrete as possible for young people is helpful. And if they can understand that concept of this represents this, that can be quite helpful.
Now, I was thinking also, do you think there's a space to allow for the emotions that may come up but might come through behaviour? So like you said, you can do the visual concrete, the transfer. So like you said, you've got something physical, but you might find our young people might show some distress, some anxiety, some trepidation, because like you said, something's come to an end and we've done the work visually, we've done, like you said, something maybe physical.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think there's a space where the emotions may still come up?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's totally normal for all of us to process endings and loss in different ways. And just being able to observe something in a session or in the class or at home, I wonder if this is what's happening for you. And the person can tell us very clearly if you are or not. Yes. There's nothing wrong with hypothesising. I wonder if this is how you're feeling. I wonder if this is what's going on for you. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Or.
Yeah, because you're not telling. What you're doing is you're doing like an outward thought. I wonder. So you're just, you're putting it out there for them. Can it help also if you see, like, I think I'm seeing you look like you're frowning, your eyebrows have like come close together, or you're, and describing what you're seeing, and just like you said, just wondering. So you're not saying, I think you are feeling, you're not assuming, but you're just going.
So you're touching on two things here. So I think you're right about describing facial expressions or bodily movements and saying, I'm wondering if that means a particular feeling. It's also important because some of our young people are quite compliant or just say yes and agree. So it's a mixture of you can describe the outward demeanour of someone to check if that fits with their internal feelings, because the outside doesn't always fit with the inside. We've all been there before. Very nervous on the inside, but picture calm and repose on the outside. So it's not assuming that what's on the outside is what they're feeling, but checking. I guess the other bit is whether our young people are able to connect with physiological feelings of emotion. So that physiological bit of emotion can sometimes be very close. So if you think about when you're really, really excited or you have adrenaline because you're quite anxious about something, and you can physically feel a bit similar. If you haven't got a well-developed sense of interoception, so those feelings that are inside your body, you might not be able to tell the difference between one emotion and another emotion. So that's a tricky one.
Mm-hmm.
But always worth asking, a young person, am I seeing this right?
I wanted to just go back. You talked when you did the jar of, I'm sorry if it's pebbles or mussels. And I was thinking about that emotional development where a little one can move to something that might be quite special for them. So be that a teddy bear, be it a toy, and that sometimes is really important to have with them.
So I think you're touching on the idea of transitional objects there.
Yes, if you could explain transitional objects. Yeah, in what I'm trying to say is where, it comes important to them. And I know for some of the pet carers I talk to, they sometimes need them, like if they're going somewhere, they put them somewhere safe, or there's a worry if they lose them. But it just made me think about sometimes that can help when we're emotionally moving from a person to a person having something.
So transitional objects, again, we understand this in the context of our little children.
Yes.
They might have a blankie or a teddy that they've had from very, very, very young, and it has a particular smell and a particular physical feeling, and it gives them comfort. And it's called a transitional object because our main object is our primary carer. And a transitional object is someone that helps us move from one primary care to another primary care. So transitional objects then start to play a place when children go to nursery or to grannies for first overnight. Mm-hmm. So parents can have their first kind of night out by themselves or day out by themselves or what have you. Transitional objects are kind of a representation of that safety and security from their primary carer. And so we do see a lot of that. And I guess we see more of that with our children.
Yes.
Who have a learning disability and or other developmental conditions. We see a lot of that because there's a strong likelihood that their emotional development is much, much younger. So if they're much younger in emotional development, they're still not quite ready to detach. So when we talk about attachment, child develops a relationship with a primary carer and then a secondary carer and then is able to then start to attach to other people. And that traditionally happens in neurodevelopmentally developing children kind of about the time when they are able to walk and talk and go off to nursery or primary school. So that will generally normally happen at the same time. I guess our children must not necessarily be walking, might not necessarily be talking, might not have mastered some of those independent skills like toilet and dressing, so because they have some developmental delays. So their development is limited alongside their emotional development. So I don't know if that's making sense, Jenna, in terms of the increased likelihood of a transitional object being used is alongside their emotional development.
And sorry, I talked over again. I'm terrible for doing that. Sorry, Paul, I'll let you finish. I was just thinking what comes across to me is that it is part of the normal emotional development stages, is that object of transition. It's important to have, but it might come later. So we might see it in the children we support when they're older because they're moving through that stage. But it made
also,
slower. It made me wonder, like, for some people, they might find that difficult for maybe an older, younger person to be having that need for maybe a toy or something because they're seeing, well, you're 15 now, so you don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think when I say that? Like, because again, if we're thinking they're emotionally younger and they need it, where does that kind of sit and how they may be perceived? Because you're 15 now, so you shouldn't need it, but emotionally, actually, do need it because I'm still at that stage.
I guess it's the same principle, really, isn't it? It's if it's helping that person, that young person, feel that they are taking part of their safe space from home into a situation that makes them feel less secure, then that's going to be helpful for them to manage that transition to a different environment. I would say that if that's the case as well, it might be helpful to look at where are the safe relationships in that environment. So the relational approach in that environment could be worked on in a different way.
Yeah.
Then the other thing to think about is you might see different types of transition objects that might be a bit harder and a bit less about cuddlies and a bit more about kind of special interest, maybe.
Okay.
But it does help, again, might still help that person feel secure because it is a predictable object and it doesn't change. And I think that's the thing about transitional objects, that they're quite predictable. So if you think about a blanket, it has a particular smell, as a particular field, and that's consistent, and that consistency is reassuring.
And I was thinking transitions are a time where you haven't got those consistency and that safety. It's quite an open sphere where it doesn't feel safe and it doesn't always feel contained. You're going through change. So
yeah.
Having something that helps you feel safe emotionally, and like you said, engaging in the senses might help you just feel a bit safer.
Yeah, it's like a touchstone, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It just helps make someone kind of just recalibrate.
I was also thinking, you said about those relationships and being safe. Is it also we need to take, when you talked theory of mind, so when knowing if someone's coming back or not, mm-hmm. if we're working with a young person who's emotionally younger, is it trying to hold in our mind, if I just nip to the toilet now, actually to let them know that I've left, who is that person? Because without, I imagine that could be a bit worrying if I'm not able to emotionally be contained and I'm relying on my person who I connect with.
So two sides to that question again.
Mm.
One is that yes, if you haven't got theory of mind and your third person steps out of the room, you don't know when they're coming back. You can't imagine where they're at.
Got you.
And then if the other side of the coin is if you do this regularly, reliably, so just popping out, but Jenna's here, Jenna's going to be your third person. I'm popping out, I'll be 10 minutes and I'm back. And then after 10 minutes, you come back and say, hey, I'm back. I can pick up from Jenna now. Sounds like a laborious thing to do. But actually, that increases trust and predictability, which increases feelings of security. And that person is still emotionally available to you.
Because I was thinking when you talk of the developmental milestones going through, about 9 months we see babies become that aware of strangers and that kind of, you're not my safe person. So I'm thinking for our young people, like you said, if we don't know where they've gone, it can feel quite scary for them. And then suddenly if you don't know this person who may come in and look after you, that's going to be really quite, could be quite scary. So again, that relationship I'm hearing is really important.
We have that innate fear, don't we, of what's strange and unfamiliar to us.
Yes.
And that's babies' kind of natural defence mechanisms.
Yeah.
I don't know you. I'm not going to let you pick me up and cuddle me. And that's a natural protective factor for them. Same thing with... we see lots of food difficulties with little ones that, when they can reach that neophobic phase, etc. And it's a time when a young person, a little person, is trying to work out for themselves what's safe and what's not safe.
Yeah.
Because for that 9 month stage, the primary carer does everything for the baby. And then that's the whole point of, I guess, of developmental stages, that this is when the child becomes more aware and starts testing out in different ways, particularly when they get to 2 months.
And I imagine, like you said, with the emotional development, and it can take longer to move through a stage, that for parents and carers, maybe where their child is mirroring that toddler stage where they might be experiencing what we describe in toddler terms as a tantrum. I know we'd be more thoughtful around that language when we're working with our young people, but I imagine that can be quite a hard stage. Like you said, asserting the independence, taking risks, but actually not able to keep safe all the time. So it's quite a lot there to navigate in those emotional development stages.
I think you said earlier, a young person might have had 16 years on the planet.
Yeah.
So they have had life experiences, but the learning disability has limited the learning that they can take from some of those experiences. And their emotional developmental stage may still be at a much younger age. That's the challenge, I guess, in terms of understanding. Still need to meet that young person's level of emotional development, and we can do that in kind of creative ways that it fits with their chronological age, but still meets their emotional age and stage of development. And I think that's the key bit there, that meeting their emotional state of development is the bit that's going to help them learn to develop relationships, build trust, and move on to the next stage.
Really appreciate your time, Paula, and I'm just thinking to bring it to your close, but I just would like your thoughts for parents and carers when we think of emotional development. What would your message be to them from today's podcast episode in emotional development? So what would your kind of just, I suppose your thoughts would be, is it keeping it in mind? Maybe hopefully today we've raised an awareness that behaviours absolutely are there, but could there be? Where are they emotionally sitting?
So I think there's a phrase called behaviours of stress.
Yes.
I think for me that's key in terms of understanding that, yeah, you're still having to deal with the surface behaviours, but hold in mind the behaviour might be because of emotional needs. I think for parents and carers in particular, you know, tune in to yourself as well and be kind to yourself, because what we're asking people to consider and think about is a lot, is asking them to think about another layer. And it could be quite hard for some people to hear this. A child is younger emotionally. And then other parents might think, oh, phew, someone said it. Yes, that's what I felt all along. I guess it just depends where you're at in that journey of understanding your child and understanding where they're at. Hopefully, if they come along to our service at any point in the future, they'll understand that that's one of the kind of principles we kind of have quite high value, that we understand the child's needs holistically, and that's our job really, to help everyone around their child understand their child as well as they do.
Absolutely. And I was thinking, so we also think of the children and young people, and my thoughts are, what I'd hope they would take away is there's a real lens you've shone in respect of, it can be distressing. The behaviours may be quite outward and visible to see in their communications and where they are emotionally. But also it made me think that some of our young people may not show it. So you've highlighted too that we see those young people who may mask how they are. But emotionally we still need to consider if they're not outward there where we can see them, the stress doesn't mean emotionally we shouldn't be thinking, and I wonder for them.
I think using the word masking is quite important, you know, and I would say that our parents are the ones that usually see when the masking happens. Mm. Because we ask our young people, they have a diagnosis of autism in addition to a low disability. We ask our young people to go into these big environments like schools or, you know, kind of clubs, etc., and attend different settings, and we do see lots of young people just coping, and then when they go home to their safe base, their primary care, to their loved ones, then they let it all out, and we understand that some new parents and carers who can see that.
And finally, we like to think just of professionals, so we've thought about some of the people who are in our young people's lives. What would you hope they would take away if it's the first time maybe they've thought of emotional development, or they're quite experienced, but what would you like to just kind of leave it for professionals to kind of think about emotional development?
I think similarly, that your relationship with the children that you work with is so important, and part of the building blocks for them of developing their emotional resilience in the world and emotional development. And, I think have a think about relational approach. Probably somebody in your organisation will understand how important that is. Just advocate for that, would be my hope.
Yeah.
Having thought about emotional development,
And I think I'd just like to add, when you said about the relational, it's also that trauma-informed approach, changing the way we see and hear and receive trauma, and actually how can we be thoughtful about the young person's story that they've had, but also family and carers too. And like you said, also considering of the people maybe working with them too, taking that real holistic, thoughtful approach, hearing and understanding, validating as you've talked throughout about where someone's at.
I think so. And I guess if you're seeing a child in distress, it's hard to see, isn't it? It's hard to see. So whether you're a parent or a professional, could you really come after yourself?
Very true.
Very true. In the witness that distress.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much, Paula, for giving your time. And I think we've really just considered emotional development, talked about the word trauma, which I'm really pleased that we've been able to have that conversation and think about, what's the behaviour, but always consider emotionally where you are. And like you said, looking after yourself too is really, really important. Thank you so much.
For having me.
Thank you.